Good morning. On today's programme, the multi-billion dollar legal settlement facing three big tobacco firms in Canada, how Singapore deals with drug users, and coral bleaching in the Maldives. But first we go to Senegal, home to 30,000 Lebanese people. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of domestic workers from Senegal are employed in Lebanon, sending money home each year. With war raging there, some remain trapped, often stuck working under the kafala labour system. Others have managed to secure the paperwork to return home to Senegal, as Caitlin Kelly now reports.
At Dakar's military airport, families have been waiting for hours to glimpse their loved ones. Faces in the crowd are a blend of anticipation and exhaustion. This is the first repatriation flight from Lebanon to touch down in Senegal. On board are dual nationals and Senegalese citizens, welcomed by President Bassirou Diomaye Faye. Some of the 117 arrivals are met with long-awaited embraces as they step onto safe ground. Senegal is home to the oldest Lebanese diaspora community in Africa. For many, both places feel like home. But for the Hachem family, this homecoming is tinged with irreplaceable loss. Hussein bends down to hold his daughter Mariam close, one of the first to come through arrivals. But this hug is different, much like her life, as she returns to Dakar in a wheelchair. Hussein's face is overcome with distress. Even the sight of his daughter cannot ease the pain of knowing she's come home without her brother. Israel bombed my father's entire house, and almost my brother's too, Rada, Hussein's sister, tells me. Her voice breaks. My nephew died. He was 14. The little girl, they pulled her from the rubble. She's 11. She pauses, choking back tears. I could have lost five members of my family if they hadn't been outside. She mixes her French with Arabic words of thanksgiving as she expresses her gratitude to the Senegalese government. Among the arrivals are domestic workers, women hiding their faces from cameras, clutching their few belongings. For them, the scene is different. Some are only met by a driver, others by community leaders. They are among the few who managed to leave Lebanon. Bintou Dedhio holds up a banner welcoming them. Bintou was a domestic worker in Lebanon who left only days before the fighting broke out. She greets each woman stepping off the plane with a firm embrace, tears in her eyes as she calls them all her sisters, even though her only relative on board was her niece. I know what those girls are feeling. I know what the bombs mean, she says, recalling the 2006 war. Bintou understands their other fears too. An estimated 177 migrant workers are living in Lebanon, many among the displaced. Most are employed under Lebanon's kafala or sponsorship system, a practice also common in Jordan and the Gulf countries. This system binds a worker to a single employer, stripping away their rights and agency. Workers' passports are taken. They are exempt from labour protections, and while they can be fired, they cannot quit. For many, this journey home was a bureaucratic battle. Documents, clearances, transportation. For the Lebanese Hassem family, their destroyed home made it difficult to find documentation. For the domestic workers, their situation is even more drastic. Bintou explains that over 900 had registered for evacuation. Many didn't make it on the plane, due to either lack of documentation or fear of returning home empty-handed. For some, the fear of economic deprivation back home outweighed the physical risk of bombardment in Lebanon. Earlier that day, I joined hundreds from Dakar's Lebanese diaspora as they marched through the capital, protesting the ongoing Israeli military campaign. Young Senegalese carried Lebanese flags, a striking display of solidarity from thousands of miles away. Dozens from the 30,000-strong Lebanese community told me how much the war resonates here in Senegal, how many had experienced personal losses already, only a month or so into the fighting. Senegal has officially condemned the bombardment, and Government Minister Yasmine Fall told the media that the world is watching as children are killed, hospitals are bombed, and refugee camps come under fire. At the rally, I met a young Senegalese boy, Ishmael, with his father, Tete Demba. He explains how important it is to bring his son to the protest, a sentiment echoed by Lebanese families as well. One mother told me, "We can't just watch this happen. When you have children, everyone's children become your own." This is Caitlin Kelly for World Report from Dakar, Senegal.
To the Maldives next. Coral bleaching, where warmer waters trigger the whitening of once colourful corals, has unfortunately become a regular phenomenon. The Maldives in the Indian Ocean is among the countries whose ecosystem is most dependent on the state of its coral reef. But the good news is that reefs made up of plankton-eating creatures can sometimes recover from a bleaching incident, as Connor Power reports.
The Maldives in the Indian Ocean boasts some of the most extensive coral reef systems in the world. The nation is made up of 1,200 islands within 26 photogenic atolls, scattered like celestial counties over an area roughly the size of Ireland. In recent decades, the incidences of worldwide coral bleaching have been increasing, and the Maldives has not escaped the phenomenon. Coral bleaching happens when coral is put under stress, causing zooxanthellae, the microscopic algae in the coral, to be ejected. The principal cause of this stress is a rise in temperatures, and the Indian Ocean has seen a sharper rise than most of the world's oceans over the last 20-odd years. If the water temperature drops again, the animal recovers. If the temperature stays high for too long, however, the coral may not recover. And if all the coral dies, the entire ecosystem of the coral reef disappears. Here on the island of Nova in the South Ari Atoll in western Maldives, a cursory look at the reef shows you evidence of coral bleaching, but overall it's a vibrant scene, with an abundance of colourful tropical fish as well as reef sharks, turtles and rays. And there is also plenty of new, bright, flowering coral growth. When a coral bleaches, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's dead, stresses English marine biologist Toby Curran, based on Nova Island. It can take a number of weeks in that state before it recovers. And if it goes on too long, where it's in a weakened state and not able to grow and defend itself, then other photosynthetic animals will take over and the coral dies. After the first major bleaching event in 1998, the Maldivian government set up the National Coral Reef Monitoring Programme. In 2022, the organisation published a report on the state of the coral reefs, beginning with a preamble in which it states that the Maldives depend entirely on the functions of a healthy reef system for their sustenance and economy. The official Maldivian government estimate of the damage done by that first global coral bleaching event from 26 years ago is a 2% loss of hard coral cover. After 8 years of recovery, another even more pronounced bleaching event occurred in 2016. But after this event, the monitoring program found that results from different regions and atolls varied greatly. Some regions were hardly affected at all over the 23-year study period, while others suffered quite significantly. Addu, for example, fitted into the latter category, with a peak in health status shortly after the 1998 event, but which then declined gradually over the following years. Since the 2016 bleaching, the same region has actually shown signs of a continued recovery. In short, corals, like all other animals in this world, have proven themselves to be adaptable, and the question is just what are the limits of their endurance? In the Maldives, the water temperature is around 28 degrees all year round, but in the seas where the temperature is a few degrees higher, corals have evolved to survive. Across the Maldives, there are also programs of regeneration where coral reefs are regrown through fragmentation and seeding. The fragmentation that we do here is essentially like cloning coral from itself, explains Toby, and in a lot of places where people are using the reef a lot, there are similar conservation programs. The more coral you build, Toby says, the more that other corals come and join in, responding to the chemical signals that the healthy corals send out. There's no doubt that coral is a resilient animal, but as the results from this year's El Niño-induced global bleaching filter through and global warming continues, the fight for the coral reef is far from over. For RTE World Report in South Ari Atoll, Maldives, this is Connor Power.
Next we go to Canada, and a long-running court battle against Big Tobacco has been put on hold in Ontario while a proposed settlement is being considered. Three cigarette giants are facing what has been described as an historic possible settlement. It was initiated through a court mediation process, which could see the companies pay a whopping $32.5 billion to Canada's provinces and to smokers. More from Dan Karpenchuk in Toronto.
The fight against the tobacco industry has been underway for decades in one form or another. Now, a proposed settlement was recently filed in an Ontario court. The three companies at the centre of the deal are JTI McDonald, Rothmans, Benson & Hedges, and Imperial Tobacco. They had been seeking creditor protection in Ontario after losing an appeal in a landmark court battle in Quebec in 2019. All legal proceedings were paused while the tobacco giants tried to work out a deal with creditors, including plaintiffs in two class action lawsuits and provinces trying to recover the costs of smoking-related health care. It has been one of the costliest lawsuits in Canadian history, with some of the proceedings going back to the 1990s. One of the lawyers for the plaintiffs in the Quebec class action lawsuit is Bruce Johnson. He says when the case began in 1998, not a single person in the world had received a single penny from a tobacco company in compensation. As a result of this litigation, he adds, tens of thousands of Canadians will receive very significant awards, which has never happened anywhere in the world. Johnson also says that although many of the class action members have died, in some cases their successors would be eligible for compensation. And he says it's a historic and unprecedented deal because it allows for the compensation of smokers as well as governments. Under the proposed settlement, Canada's provinces and territories would get nearly $25 billion, and more than $4 billion would go to tens of thousands of smokers and their loved ones in Quebec. There would also be $2.5 billion for smokers in other provinces and territories who were diagnosed with lung cancer, throat cancer, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease between March of 2015 and March of 2019. The plaintiffs in Quebec would be able to file claims for compensation of up to $100,000 each. Smokers in other provinces and territories would be eligible for up to $60,000 each. Since the negotiations between the tobacco companies and their creditors and plaintiffs were confidential, class action members didn't know why the process was taking so long. Included in the proposed deal, more than $1 billion for a foundation to fight tobacco-related diseases. But anti-smoking groups aren't happy with the process. The Action on Smoking and Health, Physicians for a Smoke-Free Canada, and the Quebec Coalition for Tobacco Control say recent court filings suggest that the provinces had agreed to a process that would give the companies veto power over a final deal. They want the provincial governments to impose regulations and smoking reduction measures as part of the settlement. Rob Cunningham of the Canadian Cancer Society says the proposal doesn't go far enough because it doesn't include policy measures aimed at reducing tobacco use. Cunningham says, in contrast to the United States, when there was a similar settlement, this deal has nothing to actually reduce smoking. He calls it a public health disaster that's killed 46,000 Canadians. Money for smokers would begin to roll out fairly quickly, but nearly half of the proposed settlement wouldn't start going to the provinces and territories until 2030, and it's not money that currently exists but will come from future sales, based on revenues the companies are expected to earn on the sale of tobacco products in the years to come, even past 2035. So provinces trying to recoup decades of health care costs will have to wait. Government lawyers and other stakeholders are mulling over the 1,400-page proposal, so it could be some time before the package is approved by the courts. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Finally, we go to Singapore, which has a zero-tolerance policy on drugs and is one of the few nations to have recently executed people convicted of drug trafficking. Anyone caught using illicit narcotics, including cannabis, may be forced to spend time in compulsory rehab. Linda Presley, on assignment to Singapore for the BBC, was granted rare access to government institutions where drug users undergo treatment. Many of them are addicted to methamphetamine and will face strict monitoring once released, as she reports now.
Singapore's Drug Rehabilitation Centre for Men is located on a huge site in the east of the island. It's run by the prison service, which makes sense because that's basically what it is, a prison. At the DRC, as it's known, there's barbed wire, a control room, CCTV everywhere, and guards patrolling the walkways. Institution S1 is for people caught consuming drugs for the first or second time. 500 of them are resident when we visit. The inmates are housed, 7 or 8 to a cell. There are no beds. Detainees sleep on the concrete floor on a thin rush mat. And bear in mind, you could find yourself here for months, even if you're a casual rather than addicted drug user. This is the second time Jack's been locked up in the DRC. In 2021, he was here for 6 months, This time it's for 8. After the first time, I told myself, I'm never coming back to this hellhole, he jokes to me. But here he is, arrested whilst experiencing a psychotic episode after using methamphetamine. Jack has no memory of what happened to him for the 4 or 5 hours before he was picked up by the police. It was scary, very scary, he says. Jack had relapsed after a longed-for romance went wrong. Seeking solace, he turned back to the highly addictive crystal meth. But even though the conditions are harsh in the DRC, Jack doesn't seem entirely unhappy about being here. Inmates spend up to 6 hours a day in classrooms on psychology-based courses. There are cognitive behavioural therapy and mindfulness sessions, and Jack says he's learning how to tackle his negative thoughts. The first time I came here, I didn't do the work, he admits to me. But I need to learn to lead a better life, and I'll do whatever it takes to stay on this journey of sobriety. In spite of the harsh zero-tolerance approach to drugs and Singapore's commitment to applying the death penalty in trafficking cases, it devotes huge resources to supporting those who've been caught using illicit narcotics. Before he leaves the DRC, Jack will be helped to find work. There'll be counselling sessions with his family. He may be connected to a volunteer who'll mentor him once he's back home. There are drop-in centres and scores of community-based programmes. And no one who spends time in the DRC gets a criminal record. Of course, surveillance is a critical part of the system too. On release, Jack will be tagged and urine tested for nearly a year. After a stay in the Drug Rehabilitation Centre, serial repeat-offending drug users might find themselves in one of Singapore's halfway houses. From a quiet residential street, we're buzzed through security gates into the compound of a long, low-level building. There's a shaded veranda with comfy chairs and a lush garden growing herbs and vegetables. Rise above is for women preparing to return to their communities. Sarah's a recent graduate. 38 now, she began using methamphetamine as a teenager, and she's had 4 stays in the drug rehab centre, most recently for 16 months. It was at Rise Above that she really worked on what triggered her use of meth. She discovered something surprising. When she did voluntary work as part of her rehabilitation, she got the same buzz, the same adrenaline rush as she did when using drugs. She really enjoyed working at a local blind school and thought, why didn't I do this before? Sarah realised keeping busy was the key. I need to manage my time and my emotions, she explains to me. But the most difficult thing for her has been reconnecting with her 17-year-old son. He was furious with his mum for being absent. Once Sarah came to live at Rise Above, she was able to text him daily. And every day she thought carefully about her choice of words to him. It was hard to regain his trust, she says. After 2 months, she was given a weekend of home leave, and he agreed to meet her. She hugged him. His body language was awkward, Sarah remembers, but he warmed up as the day went on. Now Sarah's living back home with her parents and her son. She had already started a job in the hospitality business when she was still at the halfway house, and that's continued. She loves it. And when she graduated from Rise Above, free to leave, albeit on an electronic tag, her new boss at work gave her a card, a cake, and a shopping voucher to celebrate. No one had ever done anything like that for me before, she says. For World Report, this is Linda Presley in Singapore.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Moira Hannan. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening, and take care.